Hi, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week, we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week, I'm very pleased to say we have John Murray on the show, and we'll be talking about the Charleston Orphan House, Children's Lives in the First Public Orphanage in America. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Marshall. Hello.
It's great to have you. I really enjoyed the book. We talked a little bit about it in the pre-interview. You found a remarkable cache of sources, and we'll get to that in due time. But I'd like to begin the interview by asking you to say a few words about yourself.
Sure. I was born in Cincinnati, Ohio. My father was a mailman. He really was interested in local history and made sure we went to see things around Cincinnati, like President Grant's birthplace. I went to college at Oberlin. I was a pretty indifferent student there and did not take many history classes. I majored in economics indifferently, and that indifference continued into my first year of graduate school at Ohio State. Luckily, at the point when the Ohio State University had put me on double secret probation, I ran into the teacher who would become my dissertation advisor and took my first course in economic history. His name is Rick Steckel, and he was a huge influence on my scholarly life. I just found economic history so fascinating that I never really looked back after that. I wrote a dissertation on the Shakers. I went from Ohio State to the University of Toledo, where I taught for 17 years. And at Toledo, I met a historian named Ruth Herndon, who was the next most important influence on my scholarly life. Ruth is a social historian of early America. And we collaborated on a few projects regarding children. One of my dissertation projects with the Shakers had to do with how they treated apprentices. And so I had access to some apprenticeship indentures from upstate New York that belonged to children who had entered the society. The Shakers were celibate, so the only way they had of getting new members was to bring people in from the outside, and that included hiring in apprentices. So what I enjoyed about those records was that by some New York State legal decisions, the children had to sign the document and their parent or guardian. And I was able to connect the probability of the child's ability to sign his or her name with the parents, and it turns out the mothers had a tremendous influence and the fathers did not. And that was an interesting result I wanted to continue working on. So Ruth and I worked together on public apprenticeship documents, that is, not Ben Franklin type apprentices, but children who were more or less processed through this early kind of welfare system. She knew a lot about New England, Rhode Island in particular, but she also had a lot of records from Massachusetts, and I had records from South Carolina. And we looked at patterns in contract formation for these public apprentices. And then we went on to co-edit a volume of essays on public apprentices by a wide range of historians and economists, young and old. That became Children Bound to Labor, which came out in 2009. And then I guess because, you know, to step back into the 90s, I was interested in this question of public apprentices, and I'd kind of run out of records. You know, the Shakers just had a few dozen of these. So I was searching on, this may even have predated Google. I may have been just for phrases like apprenticeship indentures. And it turned out the Charleston Orphan House records were numerous, and the indentures had been microfilmed and were available through the state archives in Columbia. And that I bought, and the microfilm was pretty cheap. So I could buy some. I kept going. That was my entree into the orphan house.
Yeah, well, that actually is a nice introduction to my next question, and that is, why and how did you write this book?
Well, I knew some records were available. That is, these apprenticeship indentures, and I knew how to work with them from my previous work on the Shaker apprenticeships. And I did kind of similar work that resulted in some articles on literacy rates and what tended to influence how the child's time in the orphan house ended, whether they went out to an apprentice to a shop, whether they returned to a family member, whether they died in the orphan house or they ran away. And all of that worked out, you know, nicely. I teach in an economics department, so articles are the way economists talk to each other. And I did get some articles out of that. And then I was talking with Ruth, primarily Ruth, but kind of her historian friends, I think of them, who are now kind of my historian friends. And they said, you know, there might be more in the orphan house records that would be worth looking at more closely. And so I went down to Charleston, which it was kind of strange. I hadn't actually needed to go to Charleston to do a lot of my publishing because I had gotten all the microfilm from the state archives in Columbia. So I went to Charleston, and at the time, it was just a total fluke. You know, from this perspective of looking at the book in my hand, it was kind of like a miracle or something. I went down there right after the records had been transferred from the city government to the county public library. And what was so great about that was that, according to the archivists I talked with in Charleston, the city government wasn't really in a position to take care of them. Not that they were... I mean, this was perfectly reasonable for the city because their archive was set up to deal with things like, property tax disputes and property boundary disputes. And they really weren't there to take care of two-century-old orphanage records. So they had just kind of stuck them away. And I gathered from talking to archivists that the records weren't especially well taken care of. So about 11 years ago, in the beginning of 2002, the city moved them to the county's public library, which has a really good local history room, and they all knew just what to do with historical records. So that was a real break. And then the timing was really good too, because when I got there, I knew there were some letters available. There are basically three kinds of documents that went into this book: the apprenticeship indentures, the minutes of the weekly commissioners' meetings where they discussed what was going on in the orphan house, and then letters to and from parents, masters of apprentices, prospective masters of apprentices, occasionally the children themselves, letters from commissioners of the orphan house to masters. There were just a lot of letters, and they were well organized. They were in boxes, and just by luck, it seemed to me when I got to Charleston, many of the archivists were kind of petite older ladies. And after the first box, they brought one box out and I looked through it and I transcribed a lot onto my, you know, then enormous. And when I returned the box and asked for another, the archivist just said, well, you know, these boxes are pretty big. Would you mind carrying it back? And I said, oh, not at all. Mm-hmm. I said, would you mind if I looked back here? And she said, no, because they had other fish to fry. So I could get a handle on how many documents there were, and it was enormous. At that time, there was no finding aid. There is now, because the archivist, Nick Butler, has organized the collection, created a finding aid. So if anybody wants to go and look now, it's a lot easier. Trick is the records of people who were in the orphan house after, I think, 1900 closed for privacy reasons. But I wasn't interested in those anyway. So I kind of had the run of the archive for a few days, and I transcribed madly, mm-hmm. and then out at night, you know, kind of walking around and soaking up the history. And I did that a couple of times, and then my family came to meet me one more time. So almost everything I did, not quite everything, but almost everything I did came from that one collection. Mm-hmm. And once I started reading some of these letters, I just personally found them gripping. I wasn't quite sure what to do with them, so I talked with Ruth Herndon again, because she works with, had worked with warning out records in New England, which were interviews of poor relief applicants that town officials used to determine their town of settlement. So these interviews revealed a lot of personal details about the interviewees' lives that I thought was very fascinating. This was in her book, Unwelcome Americans. And I started to see some similar things in these letters. Families, you know, single women who brought their children to the orphan house and explained that they were impoverished. In fact, they had nothing, they had no material wealth left, because what they had the woman had sold to pay for food, meaning, you know, extra clothing or pots and pans, that kind of thing. They were some of these people were totally destitute, and they didn't really seem to fit in with the Southern historiography that I was familiar with. And so I wanted to keep reading, which I did, and I kept transcribing. And one of the archivists in Charleston, a guy named Harlan Green, said, so how many pages of now? And at that time, I had something like, a couple hundred pages of transcribed letters and maybe 300 or 400 pages of transcribed minutes, plus all the I had all the indenture information in a spreadsheet. And he said, you know, it's really time you start writing the book. Yeah. That was 10 years ago. And of course I didn't for a while, but then I did.
Then you did. Yeah, that's right. It looks like this book took 10 years to write. I mean, it's based on a truly remarkable and assiduous analysis of these really terrific sources. And I want to congratulate you on that, but let's begin to talk about the material itself. I want you to set the scene just a little bit and tell us about how orphans were treated in 18th and 19th century America. And I have one particular question. What's the difference between an orphan house and a foundling hospital?
Oh, okay. Let me answer those in reverse order.
Okay.
I get the simple answer is a foundling house is, or a foundling hospital, so I referred to the Aiken Foundling Hospital in the book. It's for foundlings, which meant generally infants, so babies, children under a year of age. And at the orphan house, the officials liked to bring in older children, meaning, you know, certainly after they had been weaned and ideally when they were mobile but not too mobile, 4 or 5, 6 years old was when they liked to bring them in. So there was kind of a gap there where the very young who had been abandoned, for example, at a foundling hospital, the orphan house and the poor house would typically arrange for a wet nurse to take care of that child, often simply moving the child to the wet nurse's house and paying her $6, $7, $8 a month. And I think, I mean, I didn't see any systematic data that would appeal to my inner economist, but I think there was a fairly active market in wet nursing for pay in Charleston at this time. So that would have involved very young children up to a year and a half or two or so of age. So the orphan house generally took in older children. Often what happened, so there's kind of a gap you can see between, say, 2 and 6 years of age. And what the orphan house liked in those cases, if a widowed mother came to them with, kind of toddler-age children, was to recommend that the mother and the child go to the poor house, which was a kind of catch-all institution in a different part of town near the workhouse and the Marine Hospital. It was kind of where the true outsiders were kept, kind of away from most of the city. And once the child became old enough, so 4, 5, or 6, typically the poor house would come back to the orphan house and ask them to take in the child, reminding them and reminding city council, when they watched these transactions, that if the orphan house took in the child, the poor house would then send the mother out to work as a domestic, and that would end up being much cheaper for the city because it only have the child in the orphan house to worry about. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of that maybe gives you an idea of what went on with young children. Now, what happened with orphans in the late 18th and into the 19th centuries in Charleston? What this book catches, in a way, is a fairly small sliver of Charleston's life. So a kind of ballparky, the city's population was about half white and half black, and the black population was about 90-95% enslaved, with a small share of free persons of color. The slave children were the responsibility of their master. Free persons of color were in a real Netherland and it's not really clear what happened to their widows and orphans. The free persons of color who were the free men who were tradesmen founded fraternal societies with names like the Brown Fellowship Society and the Miners Moralist Society that aimed to take care of widows and orphans. Mm-hmm. So I know those existed, but they're really kind of not well understood. Now, among the white population, presumably most of the population, from a variety of estimates, maybe 4/5 of the population, were fairly prosperous all the way down to, kind of prosperous working class. And those children, by and large, ended up in those orphans ended up in their extended family. So what I'm catching, I think, in the book are the 20% of the white population that was really poor. Too poor to own a slave was kind of an official measure, but really too poor to own much at all. And that was how they came to the orphan house. The orphan house was built for the poor, meaning poor whites. And the families who came to the orphan house needed to demonstrate their state of poverty. So they would write, or they would write letters or have literate friends write for them letters, kind of letters of introduction that explained how they got to their, into their dire straits. Typically it was a widow. The husband had had some kind of job, often dangerous, you know, working on the sea, or one guy was a victim of painter's colic, which presumably was lead poisoning. The mother said that she had been in the city. Ideally, she had been born in the city, but the real kind of off and on necessary condition was that the children be born in the city. And they had lived a stable life, and now they needed help. And if they could cast it kind of in terms of a sort of exchange, so much the better. That if the deceased husband had been a member of the city guard, they always wanted to emphasize that as some kind of sign of their contribution to the city's stability. And you would think, well, maybe they're just making it up. You know, I'm really poor. No, I'm poorer than you are. But the orphan house was aware of that possibility. And so they always sent out a member of the commissioners. The commissioners were kind of trustees, kind of managers. They met every week in the orphan house building and once a week sent out one of their number to investigate applicants, to look on the grounds and make sure everything was in order. After an application came in, then the visiting commissioner would go out into the city to make sure that the family had represented their situation accurately. And so I think, you know, with that kind of feedback mechanism there, that pretty much ensured that the letters are fairly accurate. I mean, there's no way to know, but I think they're pretty good descriptions of these families' situations.
Mm-hmm. I see. So could you actually take us through a kind of hypothetical case of a family that had fallen on hard times and then asked to have their child accepted into the orphan house, and then what they did in the orphan house? Can you make kind of a composite? I don't want to say average or typical, because that's difficult, but could you tell us the stages and what happened, how they got there and how they exited and that sort of thing?
Yeah, sure. I thought this was pretty typical. Let me just read you a letter that a woman wrote to them in 1814.
Great.
She says, "Gentlemen, my husband, the late Lachlan Wright, plasterer,
yeah, I remember this,
died the latter end of September last, leaving myself with four helpless children, three boys and a girl, the eldest in his 10th year and the youngest in arms, in the most indigent circumstances. Such indeed were my distresses that had it not been for some charitable aid, my children would have been without covering or nourishment. I was married to the late Mr. Wright in 1801 and have been a resident of this city ever since. I humbly solicit your honorable board to take my situation into consideration and to receive two of my sons into the orphan house, namely Norman in his 7th year and Daniel in his 5th year, your obedient servant, S.L. Wright." So this is a pretty typical letter, which is why I included it. It comes from a widow, a fairly recent widow. Now, some widows, my impression is that most surviving parents really hated giving up their kids. And some expressed that by hanging on to their children for months after the death of the spouse. This one, I forget when in 1814 this was written, but she refers to the husband's death in September last. So it had been several months, and she had been trying to maintain the four children. The husband was a steady worker. She points out he knew a trade. They had been married for 12 or 13 years. They had lived in Charleston the whole time. She, you know, takes on the this kind of 19th century language of I humbly solicit your honorable board. And the children were admitted. And plus, this woman had two well-known, really building contractors write a reference letter for her. So I think in that particular case, that's a pretty open and shut case. Mm-hmm. You know, a tradesman, the life in Charleston, the commissioners would not have discussed that case for very long without admitting and admitted the children. Other cases were trickier if the children had been born away from Charleston. This is kind of part of this is a tradition that descends from English poor law, where the poor relief applicant belonged to a particular parish. And that part of the English poor law came to South Carolina when the Anglican Church was still established. And those who were eligible for relief from St. Philip's Church in Charleston were those who were born in the parish. If you were from St. John's or St. James, you had to go back to those parishes to get your poor relief. So one of the things that the commissioners did was to look at the location of the family. Was it south of Boundary Street in the peninsula? Trying to think of what else was typical. I mean, I guess I would say that was pretty much mm-hmm. it. Some cases there were full orphans and there was no parent to bring the children to the orphan house. And often in those cases, because there was no place to send the children to, it didn't really matter where they had been born. The commissioners let them in. And those children would have come to the orphan houses through an aunt or an uncle, sometimes the employer of the most recently deceased parent, the churches, and the city government still had poor wardens who dispensed charity. They would bring children to the orphan house. So there were most of the children who came to the orphan house were brought by their mothers, but a few by the fathers, a few by other kin. Mm-hmm. Mostly it was the mothers or the church wardens.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things, I'm sorry to interrupt, but one of the interesting things that I found is that they were, I don't know if this is the right word, but they sort of deposited the kids there.
They did.
They weren't given over permanently.
Oh, that's right. That's yeah. right. One of the recurring themes is that there's kind of a mismatch between the legal document, the indenture, which says that the responsible adult, whoever that was binding the child to the orphan house for as long as the child would be in the orphan house, and then the orphan house had the responsibility and the authority to bind the child out into an apprenticeship. And it sounds very cut and dry, but it seems to me in a lot of cases, especially of surviving parents who were in Charleston or even elsewhere in the Lowcountry, that in many cases they maintained contact with the child who was in the orphan house. The orphan house was very conscious of its relationship to the greater city. And one consequence of that was that they maintained a kind of open door policy and allowed anyone in the city, because it was a public agency, to come in and stroll around on the grounds and visit with the children. And that included the surviving parents or aunts and uncles. I think parents and children took advantage of that to maintain a relationship while the child was officially in the orphan house. And even afterward too, that there are, especially among, this was the nice cases were children who had been bound into homes or shops far from Charleston in Columbia or in the upcountry, the northern more parts of the state. If the parents remained in Charleston, then they started writing letters, and some of those letters survived between parents and children. I think in both of these cases, in the orphan house and as an apprentice, that parents tended to maintain contact with these children. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't want to get, it's that whole kind of Philippe Ariès thing. You don't want to say too much about what the parents felt, but they do say things about, you know, this child means so much to me, or I love this child. My life has no meaning without the child. And I think really the most prudent course of analysis is to take those statements at face value, because that's how the parents acted. Mm-hmm. In so many cases.
Mm-hmm. Now, is it the case, and again, this may involve a certain amount of speculation, that the parents deposited the children with the expectation of getting them back?
Sometimes, I think so. I think the parents had a couple of different, by and large, had a couple of different ideas behind dropping the children off at the orphan house. One was, many of them referred to their belief in the importance of an education, which sounds kind of trite. And I kind of treat those at face value, although to some degree, parents may have said that to sort of pull the strings of the orphan house commissioners. But they also said things like, I'm bringing my child to the orphan house because I tried sending him to the free school and he didn't learn anything there. And the free schools have a pretty lousy reputation in the historiography, and that's, it's completely consistent with everything else that was written about free schools. So probably some of these parents really did want their kids to get an education. At the same time, this is much harder to think about how far ahead people looked. But in many cases, children of widowed mothers came to the orphan house. The mother, you know, left them there, and then after a few years, she came back and retrieved the child, and it looks like she had probably remarried. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, after that happened, I think it's reasonable to guess that some of these women did expect that if they could leave their child or children at the orphan house and go out and work, that in the future it was possible that they could come back and retrieve their children. Mm-hmm. So some of those initial bindings may have been made, at least with the hope of returning in the future to get the child back into the natal, you know, some reformation of the natal family.
Mm-hmm, I see. So when they entered the orphan house, they were indentured immediately. That is to say that the orphan house or the directors thereof then had the right to put the child out to labor or an apprenticeship. Is that right?
That's right.
Uh-huh.
Go ahead.
And then I guess there's a kind of a conflict of interest here in a way, and I wondered how they resolved it. On the one hand, they also felt it was their mission to somehow educate the child.
Yes.
So how did they write that? I mean, okay, you get a kid who's 8 years old, the kid can go work, or they can educate the kid, or do they do both?
Well, the rule book said that they wouldn't bind children out until age 14 for boys, mm-hmm. and 15 for girls. So, in a sense, so in an ideal sense, there was going to be this fixed period of time in which the children studied in the orphan house. I think the real conflict of interest came at the tail end and among the girls, not so much the boys, but the girls, because once the boys kind of aged out of the orphan house, they were relatively easy to place in apprenticeships or back in their old family. But after girls were 12, 13 years old, even some 14-year-olds, they became a really important source of labor within the orphan house. And at the times that the commissioners discussed sending the girls out at a later age, those seemed to be related to times when they needed extra work done. And girls were doing textile work mm-hmm. with the orphan house, or especially, apparently, washing. I mean, washing was really grueling work. The orphan house hired slaves, and they owned some slaves who did washing. And then some of the records say some of the bigger girls helped with washing. And I think that the orphan house sometimes really hesitated to send out some of those bigger girls. They wanted to keep them in the orphan house just a little bit longer so it would save them from having to go out and hire another slave sure. to wash. So that's the only that's where I saw a conflict of interest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when they enter the orphan house, then they're instructed. There's education that goes on. How did that take place?
Well, it took place in somewhat roughly in parallel with the free schools. The orphan house school ran for more hours in a day. It ran through the summer, and they could force the students to attend. And the free school was really much more of a free-for-all that students attended when they weren't working and the parents preferred to have them work. The books, you know, were what you would have found in a lot of early 19th century schools. Morse's Geography Made Easy and Lindley Murray's grammar, stuff like that. One thing that evolved over time was the purpose and the activities within the orphan house school. At the beginning, in the 1790s, it seems like they were giving the children a fairly broad education, but shallow, really just a little bit of reading, a little bit of writing, a little bit of arithmetic for the boys. And there were several cases in the 1790s of convicts coming to the orphan house to get apprentices and the orphan house turning them down almost every time, saying, "We don't believe our children are educated well enough to take on this kind of job." After the early 18-teens, they had received an annual gift to support a boy at the South Carolina College in Columbia, what's now the University of South Carolina. And after that, they put a lot of work into preparing two boys. One was supported by the orphan house donations that came to the orphan house. One was supported by the state of South Carolina. Those two boys were prepared for Columbia at the College of Charleston or the High School of Charleston. And some did very well in Columbia, and many in the eyes of the orphan house did not. They just didn't pan out. It's not really clear why. They, in response to a query about sending a particular boy to Columbia, Henry D. Saussure wrote that they hesitated in this particular case to send this particular boy to Columbia. And he kind of went on and said, well, the problem is that most of the boys we sent to Columbia don't pan out, that they seem best suited for kind of skilled trades. They didn't really take to book learning. And so there's this interesting ambiguity about the whole educational process at the orphan house. I mean, one thing they did really well, I think, was to give girls a basic education. And I compared that in the book with kind of before and after literacy rates. And girls of the same age, girls leaving the orphan house, were much more likely to be able to sign their name than girls coming into the orphan house at, say, ages 11, 12, 13, something like that. So the orphan house did a great job of providing a basic education for girls. They seem to have put a lot of energy into preparing a small number of girls for college, and that didn't seem to work out as well as they had hoped.
Mm-hmm. So they were also put into these apprenticeships. Can you explain exactly what those are, and what is this notion of being indentured exactly?
Oh, yeah, sure. So an indenture is just a synonym for a contract. You know, there are a lot of land transfer contracts that begin with the words this indenture, you know, between so-and-so and so-and-so. But these records began that this indenture was between an adult who was responsible for a particular child and the orphan house. And this indenture contract had two parts. The top part legally bound the child into the orphan house. When the parent signed it, he or she gave up all parental authority over the child. The bottom part was between the orphan house and the master of an apprenticeship. And although, you know, these were really public apprenticeships, not craft apprenticeships like Bill Rarabaugh writes about. These were public apprenticeships arranged by agents of the city government. They were very similar in a lot of ways to traditional apprenticeship arrangements. The child, that in loco parentis authority had passed from the parent to the orphan house, then it went to the master. And the child typically moved in with the master, and over a period of years learned more and more, ideally learned more and more of a particular skill. At first, you know, a boy bound to a printer simply ran errands, swept the floor, did, you know, kind of little kid stuff like that. But gradually over time, learned how to work print, learned how to manage subscriptions, really got kind of a complete view of a particular business. Girls, it's not quite as clear. Girls basically did housework. A lot of the indentures called for girls to learn housewifery, which just meant that they were, you know, a mother's helper. Mm-hmm. Some learned, you know, kind of actual skills that you could trade on out in the market, like bookbinding. One binder was very enthusiastic about teaching his trade to girls rather than boys. So that was that kind of traditional view of apprentices and apprenticeships was what happened.
Mm-hmm. I see. And this was supposed to prepare them for to earn a living after they were done at the orphan house. Is that right?
That's right.
I see. Uh-huh. And do you have any records on outcomes, as they say in educational statistics today? You know, we talk about outcomes, person goes to college, what happens to them afterwards. How did children at the orphan house fare, or can we say?
Well, they're kind of like those present-day educational researches. There's nothing systematic because, you know, probably at your school and at my school, it's really hard to hang on to students and find out what they do after they leave.
Mm-hmm.
And the orphan house was in a similar position. I could follow a small number of students, children and young people through kind of the beginnings of their time after they had left their apprenticeship. Mostly what appears in the manuscript records, of course, is heavily biased, because you either get people who write back to the orphan house asking for help because they've had an unusually difficult life, or you get people writing back to the orphan house thanking them for all their help, and their lives turned out to involve, you know, big happy families, mm-hmm. or in one case, an appointment to the California Supreme Court. Oh. And everything. But most of those cases, those in between cases, just never show up. So I was able to track down, I guess, 8 people toward the end of the book and follow them at least into their first kind of the first episode of their adult life after they had gotten out of their time as apprentices.
Mm-hmm, I see. So let's spend a few minutes talking about the elephant in the corner. You mentioned it a little bit before, and that is the fact that the orphan house was entirely for destitute white children. Yes. How did the this might seem like a naive question, but how did the city fathers and mothers rectify this with their more general values, say Christian values or something like this?
Oh, well.
Is there an answer to that question? I've always wondered about it, you know, good Christians that they were, at least I suspect.
Yeah. No, I think that I think the overt conflict in their minds or consciences must have occurred after the war. That is, in the antebellum period and going back into the early Republic period, I suspect the question of why don't we allow black children in, or what are black orphans going to do, just never crossed their mind, mm-hmm. which is, I think it's just a sign of how, you know, how strange the past is. Mm-hmm. Because it's true. They really didn't. I think they thought that the enslaved children would be taken care of one way or another by the master, and the free black children were so small in number that it just wasn't on their radar screens. It was, you know, occasionally this pops up. So, for example, there were a couple of cases of children in the orphan house who, after they were in the orphan house, it came to the attention of the commissioners that, oh, these are colored children. And in one case, it only happened after the mother came back for the child. Mother turned out to be African-American. Mm-hmm. And in the other case, there's something going on under the surface that just didn't make its way into the written record that I'd sure love to know about. There were two children who were in the orphan house and in what seemed to be a very typical case. And then the commissioners got word somehow that these were supposed to be colored children, and they wanted the mother to come in and explain this. Toot sweet. Mm-hmm. And she wasn't about to do that. She simply, I don't think she was literate. She had a letter written for her, but her message was, if you don't think my children are white enough for you to care of, send them back to me and I'll raise them on my own. And that was exactly what happened. Well, you know, in the rare cases where race of a child was an issue, it seems like the commissioners moved really fast, mm-hmm. to get the black kids out. But there were such a small number of examples like that. I just don't think it crossed their mind.
Yeah, you know, I see what you mean. Now, if at the end of the book, you talk about the sort of general attitude of white Charlestonians toward the, I guess one would call it, the viability of their city. Yeah. And their kind of defensive stance, that they realized that there was a population that was potentially hostile. And what role did, and you suggest, I think, if I recall correctly, you suggest that the orphan house played a certain role in their attempt to maintain a kind of supremacy. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's was my way to answer the question, you know, why Charleston? So here's this very distinctive institution of the orphan house that did such a wonderful job, you know, relative to standards of the day of taking care of children. Why Charleston? And, you know, one answer would be that Charleston was very rich, even in per capita measures. If you include the enslaved population, Charleston's per capita wealth was really big. It was a wealthy city. Okay, so that's a reasonable question, but I think it's only necessary and not sufficient because there were certainly big pockets of wealth in Philadelphia and Boston and Newark. Why no institution like this at this early date in the 18th century? And I think the key to understanding that question is to look at the place of the orphan house, both physically and in a kind of civic society sense within Charleston. So physically, the orphan house was right across the street from the College of Charleston, which also dated from the late 18th century, in a part of the city that had other educational institutions. So it was seen as a method of uplift for the poor whites of the city. And at the same time, it brought all parts of the white city together. That is, the poorest whites came to the orphan house when they were in a catastrophic situation to take care of their children, which they did. Kind of the working class and middle class came to the orphan house to get children back out to work in their shops and homes. And then the upper class served the orphan house as commissioners. And in this way, the orphan house kind of bound white Charleston together. And I think that appears most dramatically in this anniversary speech given by Christopher Gadsden in 1810. And he's still talking about the Saint-Domingue Revolution in Haiti. I think that was such I think that event was maybe more important for Charleston than things like the Stono Rebellion, the Denmark-Easy events of the 1820s. Gadsden says that the importance of the orphan house is not what it does to the children, it's what it does to the city. Mm-hmm. Because it brings the city together and binds the white community together in a way that no other institution does. And Gadsden says, if you wonder what's going to happen if the white community doesn't stand together, look at Saint-Domingue, where the Grand Blancs and the Petit Blancs were at each other's throats until the slave rebellion occurred. And so his lesson, you know, kind of with his index finger shaking at the audience, was that we all have to pull together and keep the orphan house going. And in that sense, I think it was a kind of way to create a more unified white community. And that was what caused the orphan house to draw on the entire white community for charity and kind of general support.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this as a kind of final question. It's not actually the final question, but what happened to the orphan house during and after the war?
Oh, well, the orphan house, physically, the orphan house sat in the city. And when federal forces came in, they took the orphan house over and used it to keep troops in. The children moved out to Orangeburg and spent the war far from Charleston. And then in the course of early on in Reconstruction, the children and Agnes K. Irving, the schoolmistress, moved everything back into the city. So the orphan house continued physically in Charleston. The name of the street in front got changed from Boundary Street to Calhoun Street around 1850, and that's what it is now. And the orphan house continued all the way up to the early 1950s. Mm-hmm. And by that time, you know, the need for orphanages had changed. And so the institution moved again now to North Charleston, where it's the Carolina Youth Development Center. And the building, the orphan house building and its chapel were torn down to, Charleston, and really a shame of it, torn down for a Sears and Roebuck, which closed in, I think, 1983. And now the building belongs to the College of Charleston. And there is a plaque that says this is where the orphan house was. But it's really a shame. All the physical parts of it are gone.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is too bad. Well, John, thank you very much for being on the show today. I appreciate it. We've taken up a lot of your time, and you've been very gracious to us. I'd like to close the interview by asking our traditional final question on New Books in History, and that is, what are you working on now?
What I'm working on now, I have one more Charleston Orphan House project, and that is I want to make an edited collection of letters and documents that would kind of go with this book, but would more directly reveal especially the children's voices, but also their parents.
And you have all those, are you, you have them all transcribed and everything now?
Yes. Luckily now more, almost all those letters have been microfilmed, so I can do it. It's kind of almost too bad. I wish they hadn't been microfilmed, but I'd have to go to Charleston some more.
Right. I see what you mean. Well, again, thanks for being on the show. And thanks everybody for listening today. We've been talking to John Murray about his book, The Charleston Orphan House: Children's Lives in the First Public Orphanage in America. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I wish everybody a great week. And John, again, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks a lot, Marshall.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.